We would like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Preborn. When a mother meets her baby on an ultrasound and hears their heartbeat, it's a divine connection, and the majority of the time, she will choose life. But she can't do it without our help. Preborn needs us, the pro-life community, to come alongside her. One ultrasound is just $28. To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby. Or visit preborn.com.
The feature-length documentary Culture Warrior, Don Wildman and the Battle for Decency, premiering November 11th, chronicles the life and ministry of Don Wildman. It takes you through the founding of the National Federation for Decency, what has become AFA. It's a call to stand firm for righteousness and shows how that resolve can make a huge difference in our world.
If we lose this cultural war, we're going to have a hedonistic, humanistic society.
Find out more and watch the trailer at culturewarrior.movie.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. Good morning. It is Wednesday, February 26th, and this is our second day at the NRB convention in Dallas, Texas, the National Religious Broadcasters. And so we are on set from the exhibit hall, and I think they have everything pretty much set up since this is day two. I know yesterday we had some of the construction noise in the background because we were here so early, but hopefully we won't have some of those distractions this morning. But I am so privileged to be joined on set this morning with one of my favorite people from AFR and AFA, Abraham Hamilton III. You all know him well from the Hamilton Corner. So good morning, Abe.
Good morning. How are you, Jenna?
I'm great. I love being here at NRB because it's so fun to see everybody in person. And as I'm walking through the hallways and I'm seeing friends that, you know, some that I haven't seen in, you know, a couple years even, It's just been so much fun. How about you?
Yeah, it is fun and busy. Very, very busy, but it is good to touch bases with people and to see those who are really co-laborers in the fight that we are engaged in. And I don't use fight as a provocative term, but literally expressing really the contending against the powers of darkness. It's good to see people face to face and reconnect and re-engage in terms of cultivating relationships and things of that nature. So it's been a good time.
Yeah, absolutely. And I love the way that you describe that, because we're called as Christians to engage in that battle. And we know that the battle is ultimately spiritual. Mm-hmm. But when we are fighting the powers of darkness that engage in our three institutions that God ordained, a lot of that, then the tools are sometimes legal, which is, you know, what you and I do as well. And then policy related, media broadcast. I mean, there's so many different ways that we can engage in that fight for truth. So so AFA has a large presence here and collaboration with the NRB, and you are actually on the board as well of NRB. So so where are we engaging in terms of religious broadcasting, protecting our First Amendment constitutionally protected rights, and some of these issues that are at the fore today?
Yeah, so NRB is an acronym for National Religious Broadcasters, and it exists as an organization to use the collective influence and potency of all of these organizations that represent many millions of constituencies, listenerships, and viewerships. It includes television broadcasters, radio broadcasters, podcasters, a whole array of different people. But when you have that collective representation to Capitol Hill, to states across the country, it causes people to say, wait a minute, this organization represents all of these millions of people. We maybe need to listen a little bit more, you know. And so an example of how that's functioning is that we were notified in 2024 about a regulation that the Federal Communications Commission was considering under the Biden administration, which is the FCC. It was a resurrection of a Clinton-era regulation, but with a twist, because the Clinton-era regulation had already been ruled unconstitutional, had been slapped down by the courts more than once. But the Biden administration not only resurrected the regulation, but they added a Biden-era flair, which you probably could even anticipate what it is. And what it simply required is for all broadcasters to collect demographic data of our staffs, you know. And because AFR, American Family Radio, is a broadcaster, the regulation would apply to us. And the demographic data would include sexual orientation, sex, but also the quantity of gender nonconforming, non-binary, and transgender employees that we would have. But not only to collect the data, but to publicize the data online publicly to allow those who have been hostile to our mission, hostile to our engagement, to really persecute us. That's what the Biden administration was requiring. And so as soon as we got wind of that, we did what we do, said, no, thank you, Mr. Biden, filed a lawsuit. And we were joined in that litigation by NRB. And we had oral arguments at the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals at the beginning of February 2025. And I'll just, you know, you never want to try to predict what courts will do, but I'll tell you, the oral argument went very, 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 very well for us.
That's is obviously intended for persecution purposes and to give maybe, you know, the Southern Poverty Law Center and some of these and the Human Rights Campaign and all of these other leftist organizations just more information about how they can say, well, you know, you're not woke enough, basically.
Yeah, and the Biden administration wasn't coy or secret about it in their deliberations as to why they were implementing this regulation. It was to further their DEI initiative and to make sure every iteration of the federal governmental apparatus was all hands on deck for ensuring every iteration of the LGBTQIAP plus panoply being infused everywhere possible. That they stated that on the record. You know, so that's not anything that is a secret. And so we challenged that regulation on several grounds. The collection of the data, privacy concerns, First Amendment, religious freedom. As a broadcast ministry, we have the freedom to hire people consistent with our statement of faith and the tenets of Scripture. I mean, this is America. I don't care how many Bidens and pardons are distributed. This is still the United States of America. And so we launched that litigation, and it's going pretty well. I honestly don't expect to have to even appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court, because I anticipate the Fifth Circuit ruling in our favor, and the Trump administration, I don't expect to appeal.
That was going to be my next question is, why hasn't the Trump administration simply abandoned the litigation or otherwise settled? Or is that something that you want the precedential value?
Well, that's a great question. We as a ministry felt it was imperative for us to press forward with the litigation, to have the opportunity to kill this regulation once and for all. Had the Trump administration simply withdrawn this FCC regulation, it would have allowed it to be resurrected with a subsequent administration. So we're looking not merely for the immediate application and efficacy of the ruling. We're looking down the line. After there is no more Trump administration, we still must be able to do what we do with freedom to articulate the truths of Scripture, to advocate for the execution of the Great Commission, and to stand flat-footed, 10 toes down on the truths of Scripture post the Trump administration.
Yes. And this is another iteration of Abe Hamilton, who's my special guest this morning. And you can hear him on Hamilton Corner. And I'm going to join you later tonight, which will be great, on the Hamilton Corner from NRB. And this is what we have been consistently talking about enduring wins, because while so much has been overturned just by the pen in terms of executive orders of what Biden tried to do for the last 4 years that Trump can now undo, the same is true for the next administration, that's Republican, Democrat, or, you know, independent, whatever. So we want to solidify these things. What, looking down the road, even past this litigation, especially with the Trump administration having that same goal, I think, and especially a lot of the appointed, I mean, even Brendan Carr, the chairman of the FCC now, excellent guy. I really respect and appreciate him. What are some of the other areas specifically for religious broadcasters, but then also, you know, in terms of AFA action, our policy, and as an organization and a religious organization, what are some of those enduring wins that we want to solidify over the next 4 years?
Sure. And let me say this, too, before I answer that question. The Trump administration was, I'll just say it this way, a marked transition from what the Biden administration had the posture that they'd taken in this case. When the Trump team came in, it was clearly a new sheriff in town. And so I want to be clear about the fact that our continuation with the litigation was our decision. Mm-hmm. The Trump administration has not been, how can I explain this?
Hostile to us.
been hostile to our position. Okay.
So we have turned the page, as it were.
we have turned the page. I wanted to make that clear. But in terms of additional areas of enduring wins, the commitment to undo DEI is throughout the entirety of the administration. And so we've long maintained, I've said that the entire LGBTQIAP+ agenda, its advancement happens at the expense of religious liberty in the country. There's no two ways about it. There's no way you can advance, you know, a sexual ethos that violates the truths of scripture and not have a corollary, a contraction of that reality for religious liberty in our country. And so across the board, you're talking about churches. I know NRB is engaging in litigation to challenge the Johnson Amendment, for example, which always makes me chuckle, not out of hilarity, but it's sad because many people don't understand that churches do not have to register to become 501c3 organizations. By virtue of being a church, you are tax exempt by virtue of existing. The entire scheme for you to register was something that was created by LBJ to get churches to voluntarily sign themselves up to remain silent on political issues and candidacy. You know, and so that is for churches, but there are other 501c3 organizations that are not churches that should not necessarily lose their ability to speak freely because of a taxation status. So that is something that NRB is challenging. The Trump administration is welcoming that challenge. That is going to require litigation on one front, but also the bullet pulpit of the Oval Office to assert for legislation to happen at the congressional level. And so it is throughout the entirety of the scope of the federal branch of government. But thankfully, we have turned the page. But it's important that we have a view not merely for this current term of the Trump administration, but we're looking to establish a fulcrum for freedom beyond this current presidential term.
And it's very exciting that we actually have the opportunity over the next 4 years to get a lot of that done, where it seems like we were just fighting fires with the Biden administration previously. Yeah. But now we can hopefully get a lot more done. And so with that, you know, as you're describing, Abe, the various players here, and especially on the federal level, it seems to me that Congress is genuinely the weakest link here. And unfortunately, that's where the most of the enduring wins can happen.
Yeah.
And even though Republicans have the trifecta, obviously the Senate is the weakest. So where is the opportunity there, especially with Speaker Johnson and Senate Majority Leader Thune? And I apologize for the beeping. I think there's a truck that's kind of backing up over here.
It is.
We'll see if we can get them to silence that. But but thank you for that. Where are we at with the congressional leadership in some of these priorities?
Yeah, you pointed out rightly, the majority in the House is very slim, very narrow, but there's no filibuster in the House. In the Senate, you have the filibuster. And one of the most interesting things that are happening is that the Trump administration understands that they have to hit the ground running now. You don't have 4 years, frankly. You have really the current first 4 or 5 months. And my hope and prayer, frankly, for them is that they advance with the pace that they've already started with and continue that pace and see how the American people are responding to it. And that coalesces into momentum for Congress members to recognize, whoa, we need to get on board with this. And I think that's why you're seeing things like incumbent Democrat U.S. senators announcing their retirement. Gary Peters in Michigan announced his retirement. This incumbent Democrat senator, both of who were up for re-election in 2026, announced their retirement, and they're not seeking re-election because I think they're recognizing that their platform is not in step with American people. President Trump won the state of Michigan. Mm-hmm. President Trump almost won Minnesota, and I think they're reading those tea leaves. And so what seemed to be Republicans having more Senate seats to defend in the 2026 midterms, it's kind of changing a bit to where you have Democrat incumbents abandoning now. Instead of having incumbent elections, they're having open seat elections. Mm-hmm. And so this presents the opportunity for President Trump to gain an additional majority in the U.S. Senate, perhaps moving towards a filibuster-proof majority. And if that occurs, all gas, no brakes for the remainder of the term.
Yeah, and it better be, and I hope that we would have the legislation ready and we would not have to rely on, you know, senators like Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski yeah. to drop their last minute, okay, fine, or their no. I mean, it's yeah. ridiculous that we have to rely on those so-called Republicans. So what, in that instance, and getting there, of course, is a whole other conversation, but in that instance, as far as AFA is concerned, what would be the greatest legislative priorities that we would encourage the administration on?
What, one of the main things to address the Respect for Marriage Act, and this is going to require confronting Republicans. You had several Republican House members that voted for it. You know, you have others that need to understand that the American people are not in support of this. You're going to have continued advancement of other areas of clear religious freedom, family policy, legislation that affirms the reality that we need not just more babies, we need married dads, married moms, and children to build families. And so we're going to seek to assert those types of initiatives. One thing a lot of people are not recognizing, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act that President Trump got passed in his first term, it's set to expire. So if no action takes place on the congressional front, everybody's taxes will increase, including families. And so it's vitally important that families are front and center and things like that so that we can keep more of our own hard-earned money so we can rear our children, rear our families well. And so those types of things will be put first so that we have, thankfully, an open ear with the Trump administration to recognize that families is what comprises the United States of America generally. You know, that's just the reality. And anybody understands the preservation of society recognizes that strong families or weak families will determine the outcome of the nation.
Absolutely. So well said. I'm speaking with Abraham Hamilton III, who's on set with me from the National Religious Broadcasters Convention. And you can hear him tonight as well from 5 to 6 p.m. Central on Hamilton Corner and every weekday. And in just the last few minutes we have as well, I know so many listeners always write in that they're so passionate about these topics and the things we discuss and how they can participate and want to do so beyond voting. And voting, of course, is critical, especially with all of this that we're talking about. If we're going to increase the Senate majority and have it filibuster proof, obviously we need to get people elected in office. But in between elections,
yeah.
how can people best help advance these priorities along with AFA?
Yeah, and I would say that the people's activity in between elections is more important than the elections, frankly. You know, John Adams, writing to the Massachusetts militiamen, literally said our constitutional Republican form of government is only adequate for religious and moral people. It is wholly ineffective for the governance of any other. You know, George Washington, in his farewell address, said religion and morality are indispensable supports of our American form of government. In vain would a man claim the virtue of patriotism who would work to subvert those indispensable supports. And so one of the most important things that I think that should happen in this time period, that we recognize that we have a bit of grace and space and a reprieve to be active. There is no way our Article 4 guaranteed Republican form of government will be sustained if we do not have a populace that adheres to a biblical worldview. And so my prayer and my encouragement for people on the ground would be to start in your own homes and work outward from there. Your communities are determined by you. You get to determine what your communities will be comprised of. You get to determine what happens in your neighborhoods. You determine what happens in your homes. And as you work in that direction, we will have a populace that won't even begin to consider, what are you talking about, a drag queen story hour? That's not conducive nor commiserate with the United States of America, because we are a people who are oriented towards a biblical worldview.
So live locally, as you always
live
admonish.
Locally.
And I love how you always frame that on your show. And that actually meant a lot to me personally when I moved to Florida, put down roots finally, and got engaged in a church, because I want to do that as well in my life and live locally so that these issues aren't abstract on the federal level. They have to be at home first. So,
Absolutely.
Abe, thank you so much, and thanks for continuing to speak truth. We'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning. If we have learned anything from the 2024 election, it's how important it is for us to fight
fight, fight. We also learned how desperately the left wants to fight to take babies' lives, which is why every day Preborn Ministries fights for the babies. Preborn's network of clinics are positioned in the highest abortion areas, fighting for mothers deciding between the life and death of their child. Preborn welcomes these women with God's love and offers them a free ultrasound to introduce their precious baby and hear the beautiful heartbeat. This amazing encounter gives her baby a fighting chance, and the majority of the time, she will choose life. So would you join Preborn in the fight for life? One ultrasound is just $28, and $140 will sponsor 5 ultrasounds. Babies are worth fighting for. To donate, dial #250 on your cell phone and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby. Or you can visit preborn.com/AFR. That's preborn.com/AFR. All gifts are tax deductible and Preborn has a 4-star charity rating. Fight, fight, fight for the babies.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back, and we are still on the convention floor at the National Religious Broadcasters Association, but do want to talk a little bit about what is going on in Washington. And of course, the budget resolution was heavily debated in the House yesterday, and there's a little bit, I think, of confusion as far as what was actually contained in that resolution. It was backed by President Trump and Speaker Johnson, and of course, Representative Thomas Massey was no, and that's not really surprising. But let's talk to Congressman Brandon Gill from the great state of Texas on his view on this. So good morning, Congressman. And what actually is contained in this resolution?
Good morning, Jenna. Thanks for having me on. This is it's called the House Budget Resolution, and this is the first step in the reconciliation process. Reconciliation, as you know, is kind of a procedural maneuver that both Republicans and Democrats use to get around the 60-vote threshold in the Senate that's required to pass legislation. And it's kind of a unique process because what can and cannot be in a reconciliation bill is up to the Senate parliamentarian, and there are all kinds of unique and I think almost it's a bit of an opaque process. Kind of weird rules as to how this works. But the way this works is the first step is this budget resolution, which we passed last night on the House floor. And what that does is it sends instructions to the committees of jurisdiction as to broad parameters of what they need to do in terms of cutting spending or increasing spending or changing taxes. Then all of those committees send their budget bills back to the budget committee. They combine all of them into one big, beautiful bill, which we then pass on the House floor and heads to the Senate. So that's a little getting into the weeds, but that is the process that we kicked off last night. The reason it's so important is this is what is going to allow us to implement the Trump agenda on the legislative side of things.
And I appreciate, Congressman Gill, that explanation, because I think for a lot of people just kind of reading the headlines or seeing this top line with especially what's going on with DOGE and seeing the corruption of the massive, massive spending over the last decades, then there are legitimate questions over Republicans passing the House budget resolution. And you posted on X, I'm proud to have voted for it. The bill provides Americans with certainty that their taxes won't go up, and it funds the largest deportation operation in U.S. history. We promised and we're delivering. And so were there any concerns for you, like what Congressman Massey, for example, posted, that this was still too much spending, or in the way that you just articulate, I mean, this is kind of a necessary part of the process?
Well, I would say two things. First of all, this is what provides a framework for where we go from here. So we don't have specific levels of either spending or tax changes yet. That will happen in the next few weeks. But I actually, I agree with the concerns that Thomas Massey has. I don't agree with the numbers that he has. And I'm a member of the Budget Committee, and we spent a lot of time negotiating with Speaker Johnson and with Leader Scalise. And working with Chairman of the Budget Committee, Jody Arrington, who has been phenomenal throughout this process. And I would consider myself a deficit hawk and one of the, more hardline fiscal conservatives, which is why I was concerned with this. And we spent a lot of time making sure that the floor for spending cuts was at least $1.5 trillion. And we also added a provision that allowed for and incentivized up to $2 trillion or perhaps more in spending cuts to make sure that this budget resolution actually balances. So you have an enormous tax cut, which is an extension of TCJA, the 2017 tax cuts, which the American people need. We cannot allow the largest tax hike in American history on a Republican's watch. But we also provided for an enormous amount of spending cuts, and I believe that tax cuts are pro-growth, that they're going to induce economic growth, which will then increase revenues to the federal government over time. So that's the way we're thinking about this. Over a 10-year window, this does balance, and that's why I think it's such a compelling budget resolution. Not only does it provide us with $200 billion over 10 years for border security, which we desperately need now, but it pluses up military spending by $100 billion, which we need after 4 years of Joe Biden, and it balances. So it is a fiscally responsible way to implement the Trump agenda, to cut taxes, to provide for the things that our country desperately needs right now. So I think that this is a very compelling budget resolution. President Trump supports it. He's behind it. This is the one big, beautiful bill he's been pushing for. Speaker Johnson is behind it, as you mentioned, as are many other, fiscal hawk conservatives who think that this is a good deal.
Well, thank you so much for that explanation, Congressman Gill. And I'm glad to see, especially with you on the Budget Committee, that there is this broader view of the America First agenda. And so, with this budget resolution, how is the Budget Committee and also Congress as a whole with the Republican majority looking at what Doge and Elon Musk are doing in terms of maybe being able to redirect or even cut off some of the reckless spending, because Congress ultimately does hold the purse strings and we can have more enduring wins, as we've talked about a lot on this show, if Congress were to act, not just the executive?
Yeah, and that's going to be the big question. Our discretionary funding runs out in about 2.5 weeks on March 14th, and that is the big spending bill where I think there may be a little bit more disagreement about. I completely agree with you, which is that DOGE, and I'm a member of the DOGE subcommittee in Congress, has been finding all kinds of waste, fraud, and abuse. Right now they're at a run rate of about $55 billion every single year of just fraud or waste or money that just everybody would agree shouldn't be going out of Washington. That's every single year. That's over $500 billion over 10 years of waste that they found. It is so important for us in Congress to make sure that this discretionary spending bill next month takes into account the DOGE savings that Elon Musk and his team and we at the DOGE subcommittee are finding, because we cannot continue funding the federal government at the same levels that we have been after seeing all of the waste. So I completely agree with you. Now, there are lots of ways to do that. There are rescission bills that we can pass through Congress to claw back some of the money that has been allocated for what we now know to be wasteful projects. There's also impoundment, which has some of its issues. I think that that's a good way to do it, but there are some legal issues that are being worked through there right now. That would be done via the executive. So procedurally, there are different ways to do that. But I think the important thing to remember is that we cannot continue funding at the same levels we have been. I mean, our country is broke right now. We're $37 trillion in debt. We're running $2 trillion deficits. We have got to get this under control. And if we don't do it now, when are we going to do it? So I think that this is the time, and we've got to make sure that we keep this spending rationalized. And I think that that's what the American people want.
I agree with you 100%. That's certainly part of the Trump mandate. And I think that it's not just the Trump mandate for the executive and for the Oval Office, but also for Congress, because voters across the country obviously gave us the Republican trifecta, which includes the House and the Senate. And so, you know, speaking of clawing back some of this and being fiscally responsible, President Trump has also talked about either eliminating entirely or with a reliance on tariffs or some other scheme, the federal income tax, abolishing the IRS. A lot of that would have to also be in concurrence with congressional action. Is there talk on the budget committee about that part of the America First agenda?
The budget committee doesn't handle taxation. That goes through Ways and Means. So what we've been most focused on is making sure that the tax piece and the spending piece line up. The specifics of the taxation is going to go through, like I said, Ways and Means. With that said, though, I think that there would be, if we were able to create a tax structure, and this would, I mean, frankly, this would be revolutionary, but I think if we were able to create a tax structure that eliminated the corporate tax, eliminated the personal income tax, and replaced it with tariffs, that would be an extraordinarily positive move for our country. And that would be a much more pro-growth and much more effective tax structure for the country. So that's something President Trump has floated a little bit. Right now, we are focused on bringing every level of taxation down, from personal income taxes to the corporate tax rate, as well as to perhaps no tax on tips and a few of the other items that President Trump ran on. So that's our biggest focus right now. I think that, you know, once we get through step one and making sure that we don't have the biggest tax increase in American history, we can start looking at much bigger plans to structurally reform our tax system.
That makes a lot of sense. I'm speaking with Congressman Brandon Gill from the great state of Texas, District 26. And in just the last few minutes I have with you, Congressman, you know, apart from what we've talked about, what are some other priorities in Congress that our listeners should know about and support?
Well, I'm a member of the Judiciary Committee, and specifically the Immigration Subcommittee of the Judiciary Committee. And my biggest priority right now is getting as many border protection, border security policies into this big, beautiful bill as we possibly can. What that would do is codify border security into law so that a future Democrat president can't undo all of these great executive orders that President Trump has been implementing over the past month. I think that we saw what kind of chaos that created for 4 years under Joe Biden, and we can never let that happen again. So we've got to get these into law, and reconciliation is the way to do that, again, because we don't need 60 votes in the Senate, and unfortunately, I don't expect our Democrat colleagues over there to help us out very much with border security. So that's my biggest priority, and I think that is a high priority for every Republican in Congress. More broadly, we've got to codify all of President Trump's executive orders, whether it's on energy policy or DEI or anything else. We've got to make these things permanent. And I think that we're on track to do that. We've been working on several of those. So I think that that's the direction that Republicans are heading. All of us ran on the Trump agenda. So broadly speaking, we're all on the same page with securing the border and extending the tax cuts and providing for a much more favorable regulatory structure for our energy industry. We've just got to iron out the details now, and that's what we're working through.
Excellent. Well, I'm so excited for all of the work that you're doing, and I so appreciate your time this morning dropping by. All of our listeners should follow Representative Brandon Gill at Rep. Brandon Gill on X. He posts a lot of great updates there, and again, continue to do that great work, and we will be praying for you and for all of your colleagues there on Capitol Hill. And we are still here at the National Religious Broadcasters Convention, so we will be right back with a very special guest right after this.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back, and this is our second day at the National Religious Broadcasters Convention, and like I mentioned with Abe Hamilton off the top of the show, it's been so great to see fellow co-laborers in the effort to fulfill the Great Commission in 2025 and beyond, and one of those contenders for the faith that has been a very dear friend of mine personally, when I was a fellow at the Freedom Center with Liberty University, and even well before that, of course, is my good friend Ryan Helfenbein, and he is the Vice President of Communications for Liberty University and the Director of the Standing for Freedom Center, and you also have a Liberty University podcast as well, and so I joined you for that from NRB yesterday, Ryan. So good morning. Thanks for coming here this early.
Good morning, and hello to these lovely dogs, by the way. I'm looking at these beautiful golden doodles here. And I've got my coffee. And so it is a wonderful Wednesday morning to the glory of God.
Amen to that. Yes. Todd and Copper, for the listeners who love them and follow them on Instagram, which you can do at The Adventures of Copper and Todd. We'll give them the shout out there. They did join me, and everyone at NRB has been so excited to come and say hi to them. So they are on set this morning. And in fact, Copper is sitting in the chair ready for his interview. So I posted a picture there and saying, I think he was wanting to ask Congressman Gill for some of the funding from the budget committee to go toward more snacks. But, you know, we'll see if we can get that passed.
I don't know if Doge would like that.
I don't know. But Doge starts with dog. So maybe.
That's true.
So maybe.
As long as it's not going to terrorists.
Right. Yes. Valid. Yes. But thanks so much for joining us. This is a really fun set. And so we're here at the NRB, and you work with students a lot at Liberty University, of course, and have the podcast Alternative Media. So, you know, generally and broadly, where do you see religious broadcasting going as we are seeing the Gen Zers with so much of the social media, alternative media influence, and a lot of the faith elements that are away from traditional legacy media?
Yeah, I mean, it is so abundantly clear that with the advent of the internet, you know, Al Gore invented it. Just kidding. But it, you know,
too early for that one,
it's
man.
It's too early. It's too early. But in the 90s, you know, there was a big disruption, and there was the dot-com boom, and all these things came, and then the NASDAQ crashed, and there were some things that were probably too soon in the 90s. But social media around 2000, I remember I was one of the first to get the Facebook. That's really dating myself. I'm a grandpa millennial. and so we were I was at the University of Texas at Austin. I think it was like Stanford University out there, you know, because they're in Palo Alto and they're right where Silicon Valley is. They were the first to get it, but then we got it next. And then from there was this kind of, you know, what do we do with this? And I think social media has created this great technological revolution and disruption of traditional markets. When Facebook went public, now it's Meta, and then now you've got X, and you've got all these other platforms that have come in, all these various iterations. People are consuming data at a lightning speed in ways they never did before. We witnessed this politically, right, from 2020, 2021, and then all the censorship and everything else, and Biden administration was trying to enter in and suppress that. But a lot of young people saw that. A lot of people, young people, internalized what they saw. And I think it's interesting that overwhelmingly you saw young people in support of the new president, largely because of tech censorship. I think that Christian broadcasting, the future of it, is going to be digital. We're going to see a greater pivot from the analog usages to the digital. The analog always serve a purpose. So I just want to be very clear. I'm one of these people that read these books, Jenna, like, you know, like what happens when, you know, you imagine, you know, electromagnetic waves or something where all of a sudden, you know, we don't have use of certain things. You're going to need radio. So we always need radio. But I do believe that it's going to be further and further into pressing into and growing these digital platforms. And that's why podcasting is so critical. I think that's also why even going direct, posting directly to X, posting directly to Instagram, Facebook, whatever else, TikTok, I'm a little iffy on that one. But we do have something on TikTok. I don't personally use it, but we have a lot of clips of our podcast, clips of myself on TikTok, and it is gaining steam. It does work for getting stuff out there. I know a lot of Christian apologists that are using it quite effectively to reach the younger generation. So it is clear to me that as we press further into this brave new world of the 21st century, and I use that for all the positive and terrifying meaning of what that means, a brave new world, we're going to have to embrace more and more this digital, these digital platforms. And I think they're presenting us with some marvelous opportunities to get the message of the gospel out.
Yeah, and I agree with that kind of full scope of excitement, but also some caution. And I'm speaking with Ryan Helfenbein, who is the executive director of the Standing for Freedom Center at Liberty University. There's been a lot of discussion as well about AI. In fact, my producer, Luke, who's here on set, and I, when we were walking in, we saw this kind of religious tone to an AI app, which I thought was just fascinating that now there's already kind of the Christian alternative to AI and some of these things. And how should Christians, and especially, you know, the younger generation that now, unlike you and I, that remember an age before Facebook and social media and being so online on our apps. I mean, apps used to be like the thing you order at a restaurant, not on our phone. But they've grown up with tech, so almost just assume that all of the next iteration is just going to be productive and good. Where are some of the maybe more of the caution or the guardrails in terms of where Christians and Christian broadcasting should be?
Yeah, so, you know, AI is a challenge. It certainly is. It's a challenge that comes with an opportunity. Being at a major educational institution, I mean, one of the things that we're trying to do is train up the next generation intellectually, morally, spiritually, and AI can be, in some ways, a disruption to educational institutions. I mean, you just think about sometimes the propensity to want to lean on these technologies in some ways to augment or to supplement learning and education. And sometimes, and I think the big danger in that is, you know, you hear about plagiarism and things like that, and we have to watch that. The other thing is that don't take everything at face value. Just because it came to you in an algorithm, a lot of times those algorithms can be flawed. They can lean a certain way. I have tested numerous times ChatGPT with theological, biblical, and theological questions. I've spent a lot of time, Jen. I spent over 8 years in a seminary, an intense study. And, you know, there's no substitute or shortcut for that. And many times, ChatGPT in giving the wrong answer. And artificial intelligence is more like artificial behavior. It is a program to mimic a human voice, but it is by no means intelligent in the way we would define true intelligence. And so there's a lot of, I think it's a misnomer today. I think there's a lot of misunderstandings as far as what it is. This thing is not God by any means. It's not even that smart if you've spent time on a particular subject, whether it be law, whether it be a faith or theology, if you've really spent time studying and reading, you'll recognize that there's a lot of areas where AI is completely inadequate. Mm-hmm. It is a glorified bot. It's like a texting window almost. And so it does some pretty impressive things, but there's other areas where I think it can be bad. I think the biggest danger, especially on social media now, is this kind of like deep fake technology and whatnot. Warning to parents, especially with younger teens, kids, I would be reluctant to give your child access in any way, shape, or form to social media, largely because so much of it thrives on not only their identity, their name, but their facial recognition, pictures, photographs, personal effects, stories, who's in your family, all of that. There's so much information out there, and there are data collectors out there that are putting all of this together, not just, you know, oh, we got your face and we got your name. No, they're collecting information about your family and about where you go on trips and the kinds of items you consume. And it's
why we have tailored ads. I mean, there are things,
right.
And it's very weird. Like sometimes I'll be, you know, sitting, not even on my phone, just talking, you know, to a friend at a coffee shop or whatever. And we're talking about something. And then suddenly that product will magically appear my feed. And I'm going, there is no way my phone is not listening to me, you know? So I agree with that. And one of the things that you and I touched on, within the same topic, Ryan, in our conversation on your podcast yesterday, speaking of, you know, this kind of caution around especially younger kids, but also younger people being on social media, is this idea that has arisen in the modern age of being an influencer and how that's so optics driven and self driven instead of the admonishment in scripture that we are called to be ambassadors of Christ. And I don't think that the two are mutually exclusive. Like, let me be clear. I mean, like you and I are both technically social media influencers, right? Because we're brands that are on social media and we influence, and that's a good thing. But if all we're seeking to do is be an influencer, but we're not thinking about what we're influencing toward, I think, and just gaining followers, I think that's maybe where the issue lies. And so in your work with the Freedom Center, how do you engage that type of potential contradiction?
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, it's interesting, you know, when it comes to the challenge of influencers, I mean, there's so much that's going on. When you look at certain brands, they're looking for particular young people to go out there and rep for those brands. And they're looking for young, bright, smiling faces, effervescent smiles, you know.
So like that, you and me right now.
Yeah, that's right. Now that I got coffee, I'm happy.
Amen to that. I have my quad Vintason right next to me.
That's awesome. Well, I mean, you know, like they're looking for young, pretty faces. And there's in many ways, there's nothing wrong with that. If you're selling toothpaste, yes, you want a big, beautiful smile. But in the Christian world, we have so much more. And I think there is a sense in which, and I think there's a warning, this is for the church, you know, don't be so quick to lay on hands to approve someone in that position of being an authority. And some people can see influencers as a tacit moral or spiritual authority because they are communicating in certain ways. And I have seen, Jen, I know you have too, we have seen and been disappointed at times to see moments that come and go where there's like there's some kind of a moral test, something is happening culturally, there might be a news or current event issue, and then we see, surprise, surprise, this influencer is not theologically equipped, hasn't been trained in the church, there's no discipleship, and they just blow up, and they don't have a way to respond because they've never actually been trained. And so that there's a warning there. I think Christians have to do it differently, and so we need approved men and women who are coming up. And when I'm approved, I don't mean that we have some clerical, you know, magisterium that everybody's got to report to, but I'm just saying Christian ministries, that's something that Liberty cares about, is making sure that the people that are speaking to our students, the people that appear in convocation, the people that are communicating are people that we say, hey, look, nobody's perfect, but this person has at least been consistent and is a little bit more seasoned in life, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah. And I think that to underscore your point, I think that's so true that in the age of optics driven media, we need to make sure as Christians to not be optics driven over the substance. And, you know, there is nothing wrong with looking good, with producing high quality content. I think sometimes the Christian content is assumed to be sort of this B grade lesser, and I don't think we should. I think we should have the best media. I think we should have the best of whatever it is that we are doing, because we're doing it to the glory of God. But we shouldn't value just the optics over the substance, and especially in the context of churches or even Christian ministries like Liberty University or AFA, we need to make sure that the substance is there first, and then continue to build on that. And for young people who want to be influencers, you know, I was, when I was in college and looking toward my degree in journalism and all of this, I had a professor who said something that always stuck with me, Ryan, that anyone can learn how to write, but know in depth what you want to write about. And I think that that's a good way to frame, you know, influencing. And we're already out of time, but I always appreciate you coming on. You can always follow Ryan Helfenbein at rhelfenbein on X and the Standing for Freedom Center. And we will be back tomorrow with Jenna Ellis in the morning here from the National Religious Broadcasters Convention, along with Copper and Todd.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.
We'd like to thank our sponsors, including Preborn. Preborn has rescued over 200,000 babies from abortion, and every day their network clinics rescue 200 babies' lives. Will you join Preborn in loving and supporting young moms in crisis? Save a life today. Go to preborn.com.